Hello there. Today is Thursday, June 28th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump now gets a chance to dramatically change the nation's highest court.
Our search for a new justice of the United States Supreme Court that will begin immediately.
The Kremlin confirms an upcoming summit between Russian President Vladimir Putin and President Trump. A federal judge orders families separated at the U.S.-Mexico border to be reunited. Also ahead, the father of the late King of Pop, Michael Jackson, has died. It's all on today's International Edition. Justice Anthony Kennedy, a moderate on the U.S. Supreme Court, announced his retirement Wednesday, giving President Trump a coveted opportunity to replace him with a more conservative judge and alter the makeup of the nation's highest court. Kennedy, who is 81 years old, has served on the court for 30 years. He has often cast a decisive vote on significant cases, including those involving abortion and gun control. He also authored a landmark 2015 ruling that legalized gay marriage in the U.S. But following Kennedy's retirement announcement, civil rights leaders held a telephone press briefing talking about what they believe is at stake with President Trump choosing a successor. Vanita Gupta is president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights.
It's clear that President Trump has no regard for the rule of law or democratic traditions, and he brazenly flouts the Constitution, demands loyalty from his officials, from judges, from the American people. He's been ridiculing the free press and denigrating individual judges and actively undermining our institution. And the responsibility now falls to the Senate to preserve the integrity of the Supreme Court. All senators need to put country over party and use all the tools available to them to stop President Trump's plan to take over the Supreme Court for the next 40 years. No one should be considered for the Supreme Court until the people have a say in November.
Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer echoing that sentiment, calling out Republican Leader Mitch McConnell, who refused to hold hearings for the last nomination put forward by President Barack Obama.
Our Republican colleagues in the Senate should follow the rule they set in 2016, not to consider a Supreme Court justice in an election year.
Without Kennedy, the court would be split between four liberal justices who were appointed by Democratic presidents and four conservatives named by Republicans. A Trump-named successor would likely create a solid five-member conservative majority. President Trump says he'll immediately begin the search for a replacement for Kennedy. And joining us now, George Mason University Professor Robert Deitz. So many experts say this will be the most consequential Supreme Court vacancy in a generation, and certainly one of the biggest decisions President Trump will have made so far. Do you agree?
Yes, clearly. To me, there are two important things that stand out. That is, will he choose somebody that both parties can sort of acknowledge as a qualified person, no doubt conservative, but nonetheless qualified, not a rabid ideologue. And to me, that's really important. I think depending on whom he chooses, I think the Democrats on the Hill, of course, are going to want to look at that choice very, very closely. And, of course, they'll play to the press on that if it turns out to be an ideological choice. I think a lot of this will depend on the Republicans as well. That is, would they react to a totally unqualified but very, very conservative choice? And I think that's unknowable at this point. And I think it would depend on the person. I don't think the Republicans would be willing to support wholeheartedly a person who's not qualified, even though he's got he or she has the right conservative credentials.
So Democrats are very angry. With the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, President Obama nominated a replacement, Merrick Garland, and
only qualified
Senator Mitch McConnell, Senate leader, refused to give him a hearing for nearly a year.
Yes.
Saying the American people should decide, and there was an election, even though it was almost a year away.
Yes.
And he didn't get a hearing, and subsequently President Trump ended up with the seat that Democrats feel was stolen from them. So now Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and other Democratic leaders are saying that Republicans in the Senate should follow the rule they said in 2016 not to consider a Supreme Court justice in an election year. And it sounds like they are really willing to hold Republicans' feet to the fire on this. Given that the Supreme Court really has an effect on the lives of every single American, can they be successful with that? Can they really do anything?
Yeah, I suspect they could. I'm always a little bit chary about claims coming out of Congress. If you recall, the decision by McConnell, he said, was based upon an earlier decision of the Democrats, and he quoted Senator Biden to this effect on an earlier appointment. Each side does the same thing, depending upon whether the Democrats are in power or the Republicans are in power. So I don't take much from that. It seems to me that both in the case of Mr. Obama's choice and the upcoming choice of Mr. Trump, that the candidate ought to be looked at not as a racehorse, but rather as, does he or she have the temperament, the intellect, the experience of life to be a good, at least, justice, and maybe, perhaps a great justice? And to me, this isn't decided by the simple checklist of, are you pro or against women's right to choose? Are you pro or...
Well, certainly they're voting very strongly against ideological party lines. I would imagine that whoever gets in there that President Trump picks will be in line with that, and that could change the course of American history. And the fact of the matter is that other than Judge Merrick Garland being held from actually getting a hearing, I don't recall any that ever happening where a nomination was literally refused to be heard.
I don't know the answer to that question, but I think it is a mistake to choose justices based upon ideological issues.
Democrats say there should not even be a vote until after the November elections, which really isn't that far off.
I understand, and that may well work out that way. After all, we've got summer recess and all that sort of thing, and November is, what, 4 months away, so that could easily happen no matter what. I have students in a con law class, and we often talk about these issues, and the point I make is that inevitably there are these hot-button issues that are asked of justices, and what bothers me about that is that, you know, you and others have mentioned how long these people will sit on the court. And that's true, particularly given life expectancies these days. And inevitably, the questions that are being asked, these hot-button issues, are not the questions that are going to be important in 20 years, in 30 years, or even perhaps in 10 years. That's why it seems to me that to serve the purposes of both Republicans and Democrats, the most important inquiry of a Supreme Court candidate is, what is his or her judgment like? Is this a person who can think about problems that have not been dreamt of, but who will face them in an intelligent way with good judgment?
All right. That's George Mason University Professor Robert Deitz. We appreciate your perspective. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A Supreme Court nod to the Trump travel ban crushes Syrian refugees' hopes. Iran's Supreme Leader orders a crackdown after Tehran's biggest protests in years. Amid high hopes, Eritrea and Ethiopia are moving toward peace. And the UN is gravely concerned about fighting in southern Syria. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The GOP-led House has killed a sweeping immigration bill written by Republicans. Many of the most conservative lawmakers opposed the bill because they said it would create a path to citizenship for several hundred thousand young immigrants already living in the U.S., years ago were brought illegally to the country by their parents. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The defeat's not a surprise, given GOP infighting and Democrats refusing to back the bill. President Trump urged Republicans to vote yes in a last-minute tweet days after telling them not to bother with immigration legislation. That left some lawmakers nervous about voting for it out of fear he would again change his mind. The bill would have given the so-called Dreamers a chance for citizenship, a proposal soundly rejected by conservatives, whom the GOP's worried about alienating. It would also have financed the president's proposed border wall, limited illegal immigration, and curbed family separations. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Meanwhile, a U.S. federal judge has ordered the government to reunite immigrant parents and children separated after they illegally crossed the border. It's part of a preliminary injunction halting those separations unless the parent is unfit or presents a danger to the child. The case was brought by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of some of the families authorities split up. Kathy Tacht-Quinn with the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights says they're pleased that the judge ordered thousands of migrant children and parents to be reunited within 30 days. sooner if the youngster is under 5, but she says there's concerns.
We're certainly very glad to see this ruling, as there is still no plan or commitment from the Trump administration to reunite the family.
And she says it's critical that happens soon, as soon as possible.
Every day that goes by for both the children and the parents is a day of trauma and anguish, and there are long-term consequences certainly to this experience, which for many of these families has been weeks.
The practice has led to more than 2,300 immigrant children being separated since President Trump instituted a zero policy 2 months ago with the goal of prosecuting everyone who illegally crosses the border. Later today, more than 1,000 women will converge on D.C. to demand Congress end the Trump administration policies that put immigrants crossing into the U.S. illegally into detention facilities and resulting in the separation of parents and children. The action is being organized by several groups, including the Center for Popular Democracy. Joining us now is Executive Director Anna Maria Arquila. Thank you so much for being with us. Tell us exactly what your groups are planning.
Women from across the country, both immigrant women who have been fighting detentions and deportations for years, who have been fighting for DACA, whose children are losing protections from deferred action and others, are joining women from across the country in Washington, D.C., who are going to band together to stage one of the largest actions of civil disobedience we have seen in recent memory, because we think that the images that we've seen of humans in cages, children crying for their parents, families being separated, are really a turning point in both. They have exposed the level of cruelty that Trump is willing to go to implement his kind of racist agenda, and they have made the country really confront the reality of immigration enforcement. Immigration enforcement looks like human in cages because that's what it does. That's what ICE's job is. And it sounds like the cries of children because ICE and Border Patrol's job is actually to separate families.
When you
go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
No, go ahead. So women, I think the country is asking itself, people across the country are asking themselves, like, is this who we are? Like, is this who we want to be as a country? And overwhelmingly, I think people are saying no. And that's why over 1,000 women are coming to Washington, D.C. to stage, many of them, the vast majority of them, for the first time, take civil disobedience to say that we will not obey injustice and we will not sit quiet while Trump uses children to terrorize immigrant communities.
What exactly is the plan for what sort of actions will be used as far as the civil disobedience?
So we will gather at 10 a.m. at Freedom Plaza, and we will rally and train people who are joining in the actions. We will march to the Department of Justice, which is the department that's advancing the most kind of aggressive and cruel policies against immigrants and communities of color. And then we will stage an action of civil disobedience there.
By
after that,
doing what?
We will block the entrances to the Department of Justice with our bodies, essentially. And after that, we anticipate that the Metro Police may or may not arrest people. So we will also bring our voices to Capitol Hill, to congressional offices.
You are preparing people to, or people that are joining in are willing to be arrested if that happens.
That is right. And it's all women. So this will be the first time in decades that women will stage an action of civil disobedience of this scale together. And I think we've arrived at a moment where women have been, you know, at the forefront of the resistance in the Trump era. That's why the Women's March was such an outpouring of kind of militancy from people who had before not gone to rallies, not gone to marches. And I think in this moment that, you know, where Trump is so shamelessly deploying pain on families to send a message to immigrants across the country and beyond our borders, I think women are again staging kind of the most courageous, bold actions. And we're coming to D.C. not just to make sure that the families that have been separated are reunited, but actually to demand that the system that is so brutal and so inhumane is ended. So we are lifting up the demand of abolishing ICE, an agency that has actually only existed for 15 every single day of those 15 years to inflict tremendous harm to communities and families. We are demanding an end to family detention, and as the first step in ending the detention camps that the country has now seen. I've been organizing immigrant communities for almost 20 years, and the country, the public, had never really been exposed to what immigration enforcement looks like. I think when people saw it, they remembered that these looks, these images, and these sounds evoked some of the worst moments in our country's history. It called into memory the Japanese internment camps. Thousands and thousands of people have been put in cages. I think this is a moment when the country can no longer turn away. And women are leading in these moments, saying, we will not turn away. We don't ever want to repeat that history. We want to demand that all families belong together in freedom, not in cages, in freedom.
That's Anna Maria Arquilla, Executive Director with the Center for Popular Democracy. President Donald Trump and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin have agreed to hold their first formal summit in the coming weeks.
I think a lot of good things can come with meetings with people. We had great meetings with President Xi of China. We have, every place I've been, we have had great meetings. So maybe something positive will come out of it.
Confirmation of the summit comes amid a high-profile visit to Moscow by National Security Advisor John Bolton. But wherever and whenever it occurs, the summit is likely to intensify scrutiny of the White House's relationship with Russia amid ongoing U.S. federal investigations into contacts between Trump's presidential campaign and Kremlin-linked officials on the road to Trump's 2016 election win. National Security Advisor John Bolton addressed international reporters during a high-profile visit to Moscow.
I think the president determined that despite the political noise in the United States, that direct communication between him and President Putin was in the interest of the United States, in the interest of Russia, in the interest of peace and security around the world. So there may be a certain element of criticism from some in the United States, but I think the president believes he's acting in the best interest of our country despite that, and that's why he wants to do this.
A final announcement of the timing and location of the meeting will be announced simultaneously by the White House and Kremlin later today. VOA's Victor Beatty asks security analyst Robert Manning, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, for his view on the announcement of the summit between Trump and Putin.
Russia's a major nuclear weapon state, and Putin has sort of revamped Russia to make it clear that they seek to be a major global power, not just of what their continued actions in Ukraine and Europe, but also in Syria and so on. So I think there's a serious menu of issues that the president would be well advised to try to work through with Putin. How much he achieves is another question.
There's a lot of criticism at home about the president being too close to Russia or trying to. What do you think of all that?
Given how critical he's been of just about everybody else in the world, it's difficult to understand why he's the one person he's never said a bad word about is Putin. I don't know what to make of it. There's a lot of conspiracy theories, so on, but that's just a reality. Nonetheless, Putin's a world leader of a significant country with nuclear weapons, and the president's right to deal with them. We have real problems in terms of the unraveling of our strategic framework with Russia that we've had since the Cold War, and that's something that needs to be seriously examined and fixed.
Could a summit irritate U.S. allies in Europe?
Well, of course. At the moment, a lot of people in NATO are terrified that Trump's behavior at the NATO summit next month will be similar to what he did at the G7. So, yes, of course. But on the other hand, he may pull a deal out of the hat. We don't know. But I think it's unfair to criticize him for a meeting with Putin. And a lot of people have, because if you're the president of the United States, I don't think you have a choice but to deal with someone they've defined as a strategic competitor, if not an adversary.
What do you think the best case scenario would be for what emerges from this summit?
The best case scenario would be some progress on Ukraine that would lead us on a path towards a resolution, and some progress in Syria, and at least a holding the line in terms of current arms control agreements that they don't unravel. I think it's a potentially dangerous situation.
Mr. Putin says he regrets the U.S.-Russia relationship is not the best one right now. Can relations be improved?
I think the current situation is not sustainable. This is not a new normal, and I think we need to find a way to have a more stable and productive relationship with Russia.
That's Robert Manning, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Recent volcanic eruptions have taken lives and wreaked destruction. Hello, I'm Rick Pantaleo. Join me this week for the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. We'll talk with a scientist from the U.S. Geological Survey to learn all about volcanoes, one of the most destructive forces of nature. Listen for it this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia. Right here on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues, with parents often playing catch up with the fast pace of technology. It's often difficult to really know what their children are doing on their electronic devices. VOA's Mariana Diallo has the story.
What about Jasmine?
Despite monitoring apps and restrictions placed on phones, parents are finding it hard to keep up with their kids. Jania Bivens has a 13-year-old daughter, Ariel.
You can't be everywhere all the time.
Bivens says the technology designed to keep children safe online is not infallible because after she blocked Twitter on her daughter's phone, the 13-year-old found another way and got a message from a stranger.
This guy asked to see my feet, and I was like, what?
When you give your child this ominous device, it's like giving them the keys to your brand new Cadillac.
Richard Wistoki is a retired police detective who specializes in cyber crimes. He says parents trust their children too much and are victims of what he calls the NMK syndrome.
Not my kid. My kid would never do that.
Yet young children can now chat with strangers on apps like WhatsApp, House Party, and Musical.ly. One parent had no idea her 13-year-old daughter was messaging with an unknown boy on Snapchat until an older daughter alerted her.
As parents, we need to wake up. No doubt.
Nathan Hale Elementary School principal Don Iles Gomez says her school requires students to leave their phones in the homeroom throughout the day.
I cannot even imagine how much is going on that we have no clue. And I'm saying that as someone who works with kids and is decent with technology.
But even being decent with technology isn't enough. Experts say kids find all kinds of sneaky ways of using their phones right under their parents' noses.
Why does it come up like that?
And as one mother put it, just monitoring their social media presence is a full-time job in addition to the day-to-day parenting.
Who's that?
Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
That's Chris.
Well, Joe Jackson, the fearsome stage dad of Michael Jackson, Janet Jackson, and their talented siblings, who took his family from poverty and launched a musical dynasty, has died. The stage dad of Michael Jackson and their talented family, of course. Five of his boys, Michael, Jermaine, Marlon, Tito, and Jackie, made the clan an instant sensation with the arrival of the Jackson 5 in 1969. His children later accused him of not being just being tough, but abusive. But in an interview with CNN's Piers Morgan in 2013, Jackson defended the way his kids were raised.
My kids was brought up in a way so they respect people, and they never was on drugs. They never went to jail. They wasn't in no gangs or nothing. They were brought up professionally and was nice, yes. I'm glad I was tough. Because look what I came out with. I came out with some kids that everybody loved all over the world.
Well, indeed, millions would listen to recordings by the Jacksons, and Michael would become one of the most popular entertainers in history before his death in 2009. Joe Jackson died 2 days after the 9-year anniversary of Michael Jackson's death. Joe Jackson was 89. You're listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. recognizes the desperate needs of the persecuted religious and ethnic communities of the Middle East and is sending immediate help. The U.S. will not rest until these oppressed people receive the help they need to thrive again, wrote U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Mark Green in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, has been tasked with providing more effective and direct support to persecuted religious and ethnic minorities, including Christians and Yazidis. To this end, Administrator Green announced that USAID had redirected more than $60 million in humanitarian and stabilization assistance to provide infrastructure support and life-saving aid in northern Iraq. The money, said Administrator Green, has helped rebuild schools, hospitals, power stations and wells, and ease the transition of those returning home. However, in too many instances, the aid has taken too long to arrive. Many of the communities with the greatest need have yet to be reached. To overcome bureaucratic and other obstacles, USAID is now redoubling its efforts to distribute the aid Iraq's persecuted religious communities desperately need. Every delay brings these religious communities one day closer to extinction. In Iraq, nearly 90% of Christians have fled in the past 15 years, emptying entire villages that had stood for more than 1,000 years. The Yazidi population has been similarly decimated. The time to act is now, declared Administrator Green. Christians, Yazidis, and other persecuted religious communities in the Middle East have suffered unspeakable harm for too long. Their plight has touched the hearts of the American people and stirred this nation to step up with compassion and conviction. The ancient faith communities in Iraq and across the Middle East are counting on us, said Administrator Green. We will not let them down.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.